Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Dear Wall Street, cut it out, will ya? The Fed did what everybody on the planet knew it would do, and you guys throw a hissy fit? Grow up. Oh, and emerging markets, you guys get a grip too, huh? With love, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 29th of January. Good, as always, to have you with us, gang. All right, go ahead and put it in the history books. The Bernanke era at the Fed is over. The outgoing chairman wrapped up his last meeting today by doing exactly what everybody and their dog thought he would do. He cut another $10 billion from the Fed's monthly stimulus plan. Quantitative easing, of course, is the technical term. That means the Fed is now buying just $65 billion, if you can say just about $65 billion worth of bonds, as a way to goose the economy. And the Fed basically said that tapering is going to continue apace for the next however long it takes to get back to something near normal. In related news, emerging markets stocks in developing economies from Turkey to South Africa have lost nearly $1 trillion in value since the Fed started talking about tapering back in May. That's related news. How, you ask? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that story.
This is a story about money and where money moves. Because right now, money is moving out of the developing world, causing currencies to fall as it goes.
India, South Africa, Turkey, Argentina.
Gerald Epstein is professor of economics at UMass Amherst.
There's trillions of dollars sloshing around the global financial markets looking for high returns.
During the depths of the recession, the one place you wouldn't be getting higher returns was in the U.S. and developed countries like it. On the one hand, their economies weren't doing well, and on the other, central banks were keeping interest rates low. Andrew Burns is manager of prospects at the World Bank.
It's kind of simple if you think about it. In the past, you're an investor, you have options. You can invest in U.S. treasuries. They're giving a return of about 1.5% in April. Or you can invest in, say, Brazil, where you're getting a return of 5 or 6%. Maybe it's a little bit risky.
But investors said, screw the risk, we need the returns. So they put their money into developing economies. Well, when the Fed first started talking about tapering, people realized, hey, the economy's getting better. Those interest rates in the U.S., are going to rise.
And in that context, you say, well, you know what? I had $100 over here in Brazil before. I'm going to pull some of it back into the United States.
And that's just what's been happening. Money moves out, local currency falls, you get inflation, interest rates rise. It's not pretty. Robert Kahn is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
We're not done yet, and there's still more turbulence to be seen.
Throw in the fact that developing countries aren't making as much from commodities, China is buying less from them, and a spate of political scandals, and it's going to be a very rough ride indeed. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
As presidents do after State of the Union speeches, the incumbent hit the road today to talk up his big proposals from last night. Mr. Obama went to a Costco in Maryland to talk about the minimum wage, then to a steel plant in West Mifflin, Pennsylvania, where he talked a little bit about the new retirement plan he announced last night. Workers who don't have IRAs or 401ks could use it. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer to dig into just how this thing might work.
President Obama stumbled over the name of the new retirement plan last night.
My IRA.
My IRA. Kind of like my retirement account. But there's still confusion over exactly what the accounts will be called.
We're just calling it the MIRA.
Karen Friedman heads the Pension Rights Center. She says the name of these accounts may be tough, but they're not complicated.
It's a starter plan. It at least enables people to save in a secure, government-backed account.
The new accounts are aimed at low-income workers who have few retirement saving options. David Certner is with AARP.
Roughly half of the workforce right now doesn't have a pension plan at work, which is where, again, most people prefer to save by having these monies deducted automatically from a paycheck.
And that's how the new accounts would work. Employers and their workers have to volunteer to participate in the plans. But once they do, money will be deducted automatically and invested in safe government bonds. The initial investment could be as little as $25. Stuart Ritter is a senior financial planner at T. Rowe Price.
The little amounts
are what end up being the big amounts later on. So we shouldn't be poo-pooing the smallness of getting people started.
In fact, the Obama administration already has plans for when the accounts get big. Once they hit $15,000, they have to be transferred into a private sector IRA. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today? I don't know. Five will get you 10. It's the Wawa trombones. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You want to know why what the Fed does on interest rates matters? And I mean matters not just to us, but basically to the entire global economy. Because what the Fed does on interest rates is, in the very long run, about the dollar. And despite the whole financial crisis thing and rising U.S. government debt and all the rest, the dollar is still it in global currency circles, the global reserve currency, as it's known. Ishwar Prasad is a professor of economics at Cornell, and he is the author of a new book about the dollar and its status. It's called The Dollar Trap. Professor, good to have you with us.
My pleasure, Kai.
This idea that you have in this book about the dollar, that it has, in fact, tightened its grip as the reserve currency in the global economy, is that because we're doing really well with the dollar or everybody else's currency is doing so badly?
In international finance, Kai, everything is relative, and the U.S. looks a lot better than the rest of the world. We still have the most trusted financial markets in the world, and the combination of public institutions, an open and transparent democratic structure, and also a robust legal framework seem to have given the dollar a tremendous advantage as the world's reserve currency that no other currency is in a position to match.
Doesn't really sound like a ringing endorsement, though. We're so good because everybody else is not.
In fact, it's a strange paradox. The financial crisis, after all, had its origins in the U.S., mm-hmm. The Federal Reserve has been pumping huge amounts of dollars into the global financial system, which ought to cheapen its value. And the U.S. has been issuing a huge amount of public debt. Because in times of turmoil, the world wants safety, and the U.S. is still seen as the safest place to invest.
And everybody holds dollars. I mean, the Chinese, as we all know, hold more than $1 trillion worth of dollars. So they are vested in us being strong, yes?
That's the point. If you look at just the holdings of U.S. government securities, foreign investors hold about $5.6 trillion worth of U.S. government securities, not to mention a whole lot of other dollar assets. So now everybody in the world has an incentive to keep the system as is, because if the dollar falls, they lose.
There is that that thing, though, that people say about financial crises, right? That they happen very slowly until they happen right away really quickly. Could you see some circumstance where the world just loses faith in the dollar?
That's a very good question, and it's a question that's become sharper over time. And in fact, in my book, I do try to look at various tipping point scenarios. The Chinese could say, let's move on and get away from the dollar because we are tired of this. Other foreign investors could lose faith in the dollar. U.S. investors could lose faith in the dollar. But here's the curious thing. All of this would in principle lead to turmoil in U.S. financial markets, which would very quickly spread to the rest of the world. When there is turmoil, people want safety. And where do you go when you want safety? It's right back to the U.S. dollar. So there really is no other place to hide.
It's amazing. Everything comes back to the United States.
It is a frustrating paradox for the rest of the world, but there really is no easy escape from the dollar trap.
So can we all go home now? I mean, the European Union's a mess and the Chinese won't let the U.N. float freely. So we're done. We're it. And thank you very much.
This is not entirely a good thing for the U.S. It's true. It's very nice if the world comes and buys U.S. debt. It keeps financing here cheap so Americans can get cheaper mortgages, car loans, and so on. But the dollar's value is perhaps stronger than it ought to be. And that means fewer jobs, less exports. So it's not altogether a good thing for the U.S.
Would you buy U.S. debt? Would you go out and buy a treasury bond today?
If I was looking for a safe place to put my money and if I had a few billions of dollars, I might. Given that I don't have a few billions of dollars, I might look for more diversified investments. And that's the point. The large investors really have no other place to hide. Smaller investors like you and me, Kai, might have other places to go.
Professor Prasad, thanks very much for your time, sir.
My pleasure, Kai.
Ishwar Prasad is a professor of economics at Cornell, and he's at Brookings as well. Another week, another whole slew of Bitcoin stories out there. New York State's financial regulator says he's working on rules for businesses that want to use the digital currency. An official at the Bitcoin Foundation has stepped down after he was charged with conspiring to use it to launder money. Bitcoin and its popularity can be tricky to understand in lots of ways. First of all, how does a made-up currency have value anyway? And also, what's the appeal of money that takes you off the regular financial grid? Well, the funny thing is, the more you think about Bitcoin and questions like that, the more you learn about regular old cash, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Bitcoin is a digital currency controlled only by software that somehow some people have collectively decided is worth something. This can be a bit of a brain bender, but turns out we do the same every day with cash.
Money is a form of shared reality.
Adam Waits is a professor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Money, he says, is a shared illusion.
In order for it to have value, that means that everyone sort of has to agree that this is something that we're going to treat as valuable.
With cash, we take paper with numbers printed on it and imbue it with a value greater than the sum of paper and ink. Bitcoin works the same way, says Waits.
It's sort of like the Kim Kardashian of money. Kim Kardashian is famous for being famous. Bitcoin is valuable because a lot of people have agreed to value it.
One reason people value it is that Bitcoin is hard to trace back to a person, something that can make law enforcement a little nervous. There's no bank keeping tabs, no paper trail. People buy illegal stuff with Bitcoin. But again, cash is the same. Jerry Brito is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
If you and I, you know, meet somewhere, meet at a park, and I give you $100, you give me something in return, and we parted separate ways, that's a completely anonymous transaction.
There's no record. The time, the park we met at, what we traded. Cash can be better at keeping secrets than Bitcoin.
By necessity, you have to keep a record of the transaction and of the amount and of the addresses, the Bitcoin addresses that were involved. So it's less anonymous than cash. It's more pseudonymous, is one way to put it.
Bitcoin leaves a digital trail. That's how Bitcoin works, a trail that cash is very good at erasing. But cash isn't entirely invisible. It's got a physical presence. You have to get it, move it, and its physical nature has costs. Bhaskar Chakravorty is with the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
I have to spend some time to go to the ATM and take money out, and that could be time that is taken away from other productive activities.
It doesn't sound like a lot, but it adds up, he says, to tens of billions of dollars, time that you wouldn't have to waste in a Bitcoin world. There's also the cost to businesses of using cash. You got to hire services to protect it, get it to and from the bank, and
they incur costs because cash gets stolen from a retail outlet or because there are robberies.
In a world where everyone uses Bitcoin instead, there's nothing in the cash register for robbers to steal. There's another big cost of cash to our society, the tax gap. All the money we don't send the government when we pay for things off the books. Chakravorty estimates that cash costs the U.S. government more than $100 billion a year. Bitcoin's enough like cash that that cost wouldn't disappear. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up,
lots and lots of inequality accelerating, intensifying is not a good thing.
Well, there you go. But first, let's do the numbers. Told you, wah-wah trombone, you should have bet with me. The Dow Industrials off 1.2% today, down 189 points, closed at 15,738. The NASDAQ took off 1.1%. That is 46 points, finished at 4,051. The S&P 500 backed up 1%, 18 points, ended things at 1,774. The Fed's decision to buy fewer bonds, along with trouble in emerging markets, as we said, rattled financial firms. Citigroup raised 3%. Goldman Sachs traded down more than 1% today. Earnings also delivered a couple of big blows. Boeing nosedived more than 5% today after a poor quarterly report. Yahoo threw off nearly 9% today. And then there is the cold. Perhaps you've heard of it. Natural gas futures jumped 10% today. That hits a four-year high, by the way. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. It's a big day for economic indicators. We'll get weekly jobless claims and details on gross domestic product in the fourth quarter, to name a few. We'll find out how much online shopping you did last quarter when Amazon and Visa release earnings. And think of how far we've come. On this day in 2007, Microsoft's oh-so-popular operating system, Windows Vista, first went on sale. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have in this country a bit of a technical issue. The amount of data that we gobble up with our smartphones is increasing and will increase. I think the term is ad infinitum, right? But our digital plumbing has some limits. Only so many tweets and YouTube videos can get through that plumbing. Never fear, though, the Federal Communications Commission has a plan, one you might really be familiar with from preschool, I think. Sharing is caring might be the name for it. The FCC wants TV stations to share spectrum with each other, essentially double up on a single channel. And the very first experiment in that is about to begin, as Marketplace's David Weinberg tells us.
The two stations taking part in this experiment are KLCS, a PBS station, and KJLA, a commercial Spanish-language station, both in Los Angeles.
So we decided, you know, we'd rather be informed than not informed. Best analogy I have is you don't jump out of an airplane and then invent a parachute on the way down.
Alan Popkin is the director of TV engineering at KLCS. He says the experiment will tell us if two channels can be packed into one without compromising the quality of the broadcast, and look at how your TV will know which channel to display. If channel sharing works, it could save stations a lot of money.
There'd be one tower, one transmitter, and that would cut down a lot on the costs of operation.
Lana Thompson is COO of the Association of Public Television Stations. In addition, she says, each station would be able to sell its unused bandwidth to the FCC in an incentive auction next year.
So the incentive auction is an effort that the FCC is leading to create incentives to use spectrum as efficiently as possible and to free up more spectrum for mobile broadband services.
Scott Bergman is the vice president of regulatory affairs with CTIA, the trade association that represents the wireless industry. Companies like T-Mobile, AT&T, and Sprint are currently arguing over how much of the spectrum each company should get. Bergman says mobile carriers could use their share to improve services for customers.
Greater capacity, faster speeds, less congestion. And so the channel sharing pilot is an effort to help make the incentive auction successful.
The auction is scheduled for mid-2015 and is expected to generate $25 billion. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
It's all over but the shouting for Ben Bernanke. As I said, today was his last Federal Reserve policy meeting. A couple of handoff sessions with Janet Yellen in the next day or two. And then come the close of business Friday, boom, he is a former chairman of the Federal Reserve, which means he's going to do what? Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
You know, this is a question only 13 men have wrestled with.
I have more in common with you graduates than most might think.
Here's Alan Greenspan giving a commencement address at the University of Pennsylvania in 2005.
Before long, my term at the Federal Reserve comes to an end. I, too, will be looking for a job.
As for what Bernanke might do, well, Greenspan's career path gives us some clues. Justin Martin is the author of Greenspan, The Man Behind Money.
It's kind of remarkable. He retired at the age of 79.
And since then, he's kept busy. Greenspan has had what Martin calls a 21st century retirement.
He's headed up a Washington, D.C.-based consulting firm called Greenspan LLC. He's had a number of different corporate clients he's consulted to, such as Deutsche Bank.
Now, Ben Bernanke's younger. He's only 60, but he served two terms as Fed chairman. He led President Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. And before that, Bernanke was a distinguished professor at Princeton.
You know, he's going to have lots of options.
Nels Olson is vice chairman of Korn Ferry International. That's an executive search firm. I asked Olson to take a look at Ben Bernanke's CV. A resume that says Fed chairman is a pretty rare thing.
There aren't many who have done this in the past.
Jeannie Brandover runs Boyden Global Executive Search's New York office and financial services practice. She says Bernanke could become a consultant.
In an advisory role, it really affords them to be more challenged, have a broader view, have a broader influence, but yet not be personally responsible for the outcome.
Odds are Bernanke will give some speeches, but first things first, the memoir. That would give him some time to think, to defend how he handled the financial crisis, and the book deal could be lucrative. Penguin Press reportedly paid Greenspan $8.5 million for his memoir. Brandover says the man who once presided over the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System could join some corporate boards.
There's going to be a lot of people that will want his name and stature as part of their organization.
There have been suggestions Bernanke is eyeing a post at the Brookings Institution. And of course, Bernanke could return to academia. Remember, he spent most of his career at Princeton. We asked Princeton if Bernanke has indicated he'd like to teach there again. A university spokesman says the school doesn't comment on personnel matters. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
We've got a timeline of the afterlives of all the previous Fed chairs. Several wrote books. One bought the Washington Post. One was indicted for mail fraud. Check it out, marketplace.org. Minimum wage and what that dollar amount ought to be has been in the news. Most recently, of course, last night, thanks to the State of the Union. But really, minimum wage is kind of a proxy for a bigger discussion about rising inequality in this country. Rich getting richer and the poor not. Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane is here to talk about what that means for corporate America. Good to talk to you again, Nancy.
Always a real pleasure, Kai.
Couple of ways to go with income inequality in corporations. So I'll take maybe the most obvious one. It is of interest to them because of purchasing power of individuals, right? If there's greater inequality, then the lowest rung can buy less stuff, right?
Well, yeah, not just the lowest rung, but the bottom 90%, right? So if you think about like how much income goes to the top 1% in 2012, and these are good numbers, it's close to 23%. And the average person in making, you know, in that top 1% makes about $717,000 a year versus $53,000 for everyone else. So just, you know, just very, very rough ballpark numbers. That's a lot of people with a lot less money to buy things and very little hope, in some sense, at least evidenced by the numbers, of getting lots more purchasing power.
Well, and that's the next question, right? That idea of hope. What do we know about whether or not seeing rising inequality is demotivating for those not in the top tranches of the economy?
If you use mobility as a proxy, right? Cause, yeah. And that's not a bad proxy, right? We know large amounts of social and economic mobility, which do not correlate with inequality,
right,
income or wealth, right, produce more GDP, right, more social order, more kind of, you know, national prosperity and political stability. You know, you can reason inversely that lots and lots of inequality accelerating, intensifying is not a good thing.
What do you make then of the fact that workers are, as has been shown by the numbers every month that we report from time to time in the last 5 years, workers are ever more productive in this economy?
Right. But the way we account for that is that technology in all kinds of forms, right, be it like a better information system for someone at the call center or a better way of timing French fries electronically, makes McDonald's workers more productive. So a huge amount of that productivity is really, ironically, about the use of labor and technology, where the emphasis is on advances in the latter.
That top 1% making the $717,000 a year.
Average.
Average, right. So let's say somebody makes that and has a family of four, and then somebody else makes $53,000 on average and has a family of four. There's a disparity of disposable income, right? What does the guy at the top or the woman at the top do with the extra change that, in theory, the person at the bottom half or bottom 90% is using to put food on the table?
The vast majority, right, goes into reinvestment, right? Buying more stocks, putting more money in your pensions, you know, putting more money in your bond account, using money that can then make money for you, right, and be taxed off, and if you hold it long enough, at long-term capital gains rates. So there's this kind of very interesting cycle where, and Keynes wrote a lot about this, right? You actually want to put money directly in the hands of the bottom 90% so it will get spent and generate jobs and generate revenue for companies and, you know, oil the wheel of capitalism.
Nancy Cain at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, it is the last time I'll talk about the State of the Union address. Till next year, I suppose. The president, as you heard, mentioned a bunch of companies last night. Most of them are big enough they don't need a presidential shout-out. But then the president said this.
Nick Shute is here today with his boss, John Serrano. John's an owner of Punch Pizza in Minneapolis. And Nick helps make the dough. Only now he makes more of it.
So we had to call him up, right? We got a hold of John Puckett. He is a co-owner of Punch Pizza along with John Serrano. And I asked him what happened when the White House called.
We really thought it was a practical joke at first.
But good for business.
It's been incredible. More on social media. The nice thing is it's warming up above minus 20 today in Minnesota. So we'll probably see it more today than last night. I think everybody was still hunkered down, probably watching the State of the Union last night.
Turns out, tragically enough, the president didn't even get to taste the pizza.
You know, it doesn't transport that well from St. Paul to Washington. Ours is, wood-fired Neapolitan pizza, and it's best when you get it right out of the oven.
Pizza and a beer right now, am I right? Come on. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.